Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Wednesday, April the 9th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open as a subcommittee of two of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. And I'm going to open a public hearing with a presentation on access management. Is that correct? No.
Testimony.
Okay. Invited public testimony. All right. Very good. That's why you always ask. Good morning.
All right. Good morning, Chair George and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Slater. I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. Joining me this morning is ODOT employee John Schmidgall, who is our chief bargainer, and Chuck Wins, who's SEIU's ODOT organizer. We're here today to respond to the testimony Representative Krupp gave this committee last week, in which he outlined a concept of privatizing ODOT maintenance. Since Representative Krupp did not go into detail about his plan, our testimony raises some general concerns we have regarding his concept. If Representative Krupp returns with a more specific plan, I hope the committee will allow us to return and provide some in-depth analysis of his proposal. And we will be brief today. I know that you have a number of things on your agenda. We have three main points that I'll outline briefly before we go into more detail. The first is that privatizing ODOT maintenance is a solution to a problem that does not exist. The second is the cost of privatizing maintenance may be much higher than the committee realizes. And finally, Oregon risks substituting high-quality services and dedicated employees for low-quality service and poorly motivated employees. Let me begin with the idea that privatizing ODOT maintenance is a solution to a problem that does not exist. Government typically considers privatizing essential public services, and I think we can all agree that road maintenance on highways and bridges is an essential public service in response to one of three perceived problems: a belief that the public sector is providing goods or services either too poorly or too expensively when compared with the private sector, or public goods and services require specialized skill or equipment that is better provided by the public sector, by the private sector. And I think the example to this is heavy highway construction, where ODOT doesn't want to maintain the equipment and be in a position of actually building roads and highways. And third, the third reason that we can see privatization is that a political constituency is demanding to do business with government. And we've certainly seen cases of privatization and contracting out that are really more about political patronage than public policy. Although, of course, that's not the issue today. I understand that. In the case of ODOT maintenance, none of these three situations exist. No one is suggesting that ODOT maintenance is providing a service that is of poor quality or is too expensive. No one is suggesting that maintenance lacks the technical skill or equipment to provide the service. And no one is breaking down the doors to bid on maintaining the state's highways. I would encourage this committee to heed the medical profession's principle of first do no harm. The second point that I'd like to raise is the cost of privatizing maintenance may be higher than you think. I'll be honest and say that I'm as comfortable talking about New Zealand's road maintenance problem program as I am driving on the left-hand side of the road. I do think it's fair to say that we can probably learn more from privatization efforts in the United States than we can from those taking place in New Zealand. After all, if I brought a proposal, say, to solve our healthcare crisis in Oregon based on Norway's system, I doubt many of you would take me too seriously. Fortunately for us, although unfortunately for those states that have tried it, there are a few examples of privatizing DOT maintenance. Massachusetts is one state that tried this. In 1992, then-Governor William Weld pursued a privatization initiative that resulted in privatizing a portion of Mass Highways maintenance. There were several problems. Only six firms had the capacity to bid on the whole package of the state's maintenance needs. Thus, Massachusetts failed to gain the benefits of a truly competitive marketplace because there was simply not enough competition. The second problem was that it was very difficult for the bidders to cost out the projects. Bids ranged from $3.7 to $8.1 million. The state had valued the contract at a little over $4 million. After 1 year, the House Audit Committee of the Massachusetts Legislature studied the privatized maintenance program and concluded that while the contractor did not violate any terms of the contract, the quality was substandard and was $1.1 million more expensive than the work performed by state employees. Although I focused on Massachusetts, California also flirted with contracting with private companies for highway maintenance, but ultimately abandoned the experiment as too expensive. Let me give you one more example that's not from maintenance but is from a state DOT. Ohio DOT contracted with a private firm for some of its bridge inspection work. A comparison of in-house inspection versus private inspection concluded that in-house costs were, on average, 28% lower than outside contractors. So there's just a couple examples about some of the problems with privatizing ODOT services. I want to raise kind of some larger conceptual problems around the concept of privatizing public services. One is that there are often not enough bidders to have a genuinely competitive marketplace for government contracts. The result is that government may simply trade one monopoly, ours, for another monopoly. And I think the example that we see often is in the defense industry, where essentially two defense companies bid for government projects. You don't really get the benefits of a competitive marketplace. And I think one of the questions that the committee would have to ask is there genuine competition for this product in the marketplace? And this is especially true in rural areas. Are there enough bidders out in rural areas to actually do the maintenance work in the highways? We could actually have a situation where I think we get the worst of both worlds, which is we have kind of Portland-Salem corridor-based folks bidding on kind of the best projects, leaving the most expensive rural areas for the state to pick up and maintain. The second is that savings from privatization, when they do exist, are often realized only after selling off the public assets. And I think that was one of the features of Representative Krupp's proposal, that after a two-year period of time, the state would sell off its current assets, such as the trucks and other snowplows and other vehicles that they use. The problem is, once you choose to sell off your assets, if the contractor doesn't perform, you've essentially locked yourself into a privatizing strategy. You would then have to go out and repurchase all those assets in order to take the work back from the private contractor. Given kind of our current fiscal situation, I can't really see that that's a realistic scenario. The state of Pennsylvania actually wound up in a situation where it contracted out some services, sold off its assets, and then was forced to repurchase those assets in order to take the work back when the contractor failed to do the work that it had contracted to do. The third issue is that privatization often costs more money because of contract compliance. For instance, it costs more to administer the contract and to monitor the results. It takes additional money to train and supervise contractor personnel, and the use of public equipment and facilities is often not included in the costs of contracted services. In the worst case scenario, government may find itself taking its contractors to court to enforce or end a contract. And then, of course, has the responsibility of either letting out another bid or taking those services back in-house. And yet another aspect of this is that you lose the employees that have the skills to perform the work. So you wind up gearing up all over again to bring back the people that you need to do the work should you be in a situation of having to take the work back over. Finally, control disappears, but not accountability. Government and its managers can no longer direct the work and make changes in response to problems and opportunities, but the public still holds government and office holders accountable for the quality of public services. I think regardless of who does the work on maintaining our highways, whether it's private or public sector, ultimately the public is going to look to government to make sure that roads are well maintained. Let me give just one example that was reported in the Wall Street Journal about this situation. In 1996, the city of New Orleans contracted with a private company to collect garbage. To save money and generate a better profit, the contracted garbage company turned around and contracted with a temporary agency for low-wage workers to pick up the garbage who were not trained or provided with safety equipment. There were serious problems with service as a result. In 1 month, the garbage company missed 8,800 stops, leaving piles of garbage to build up in New Orleans streets in the hot summer. The city imposed fines and ultimately sued to take the contract back in-house. I can just imagine what the city residents must feel when they were seeing the garbage pile up, and they called their city officials and were told that, well, that's not our problem, it's a private company. Ultimately, it's going to come back to the public sector. Let me just conclude my remarks by stating the obvious. The highway system is one of the most important components of the state economy, as it provides the way to move goods to markets and connect employers to employees. Let's not put our economy in jeopardy by embarking on a speculative scheme of privatization. And let me turn to John to talk a moment about the quality services that public employees render.
My name is John Schmidman. I'm a maintenance worker out of Salem. And I'm not really used to doing this right here. My job is out on the highway there where the tire meets the road. And where we shine is when them highways get plugged up, and we come out and help the traffic get going again and do the maintenance out there. And that's what we do, and that's what we're proud to do for the state of Oregon. What I'm going to talk a little bit about is in the past we've had contractors come in and do work for us, and the state has tried contracting out some of our work. And in the past we've had situations where the quality of the work has gone downhill to the point where it ends up we have to come back on a continuing basis and repair things, fix things, put things back the way they are supposed to be. And a couple of examples I'll give you is I think around in 89 we had some work done on a highway that goes toward the falls, and they were supposed to put some paving down. And the first time that I looked at after it was done, I thought, well, this looks like somebody came in and did a job here that didn't have any experience at all, and they were training on it, and there was nobody there to train them. What I'm talking about is the width of the highway. In some areas, it's a foot and a half short, narrower than it should be. In areas, it's a little bit wider, and what happens is the trucks that run on the edges then break off the edge because the road's not wide enough, and it creates holes on the edges of the road. We have to continually be coming back and filling those holes and putting the gravel back. A lot of times when they pave out there, they don't put the gravel back up to the edge of the road, and then we tend to have to put the rock back up there and keep the edges from breaking off, because once the edges start breaking off, it wants to start eating the highway up. We've had contractors come in and do guardrail work, and that didn't seem to work out. They've come in and mowed for us. They've done chip seals for us. It just, we take pride in our highways because we're the ones out there doing the work. And when we do the initial work, we want to see it done right so we don't have to come back and do it again. We have other things. We have a lot of things to do. And to redo a job, takes the extra time, and we don't want to have to be able to do that. We maintenance guys, through, and I can speak pretty much throughout the state, we take ownership of our highways, and every day we come to work because that's what we do, and that's what we get paid to do, and we want to give the state the best bang for their buck, and we treat our highways somewhat like a family, and we treat our crew somewhat like a family. And when we're out there working on the highways, it's because we have pride in what we do, and we like what we do, and therefore we would like you to reconsider privatizing.
So is this a very imminent thing that is going to be happening in the department?
My sense is that it may not be. Representative Krupp came and gave, I think, a very general overview of what it might look like in terms of trying to help create a private corporation that could then bid for the state for the maintenance contract and over a period of time, and where the assets would be sold off after a few years. And our concern was just that it was a very speculative scheme without a real process. There was no real competitive bidding process that would be going on. And I think that there were a lot of hidden costs that were just not brought out, and we wanted to start to air some concerns before the plan developed any further shape to it, and alert the committee that there may be a lot of hidden dangers to it.
Is there a bill?
Are you aware of Senate Bill 717?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, not, no. The answer doesn't.
There is a hearing today in general government. I would invite you to look at the bill and look at the summary. I don't want to take up time in this hearing, but what the bill does, it provides a process within government to identify, and it isn't just highway, there's a whole host of services that would lend themselves to outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
and it provides an opportunity for the public sector to bid against the private sector. Your reference to replacing one monopoly for another monopoly, as a matter of public policy, one of the concerns is, in a monopolistic system, how do you assure yourself that you are achieving quality at the least cost and efficiency? And this is an attempt to create that process with some discipline that would provide competition for the services that the public receive, but do it in a competitive way. I'm a contractor by background. I understand competition promotes excellence in efficiencies. And in the government sector, that in a monopolistic system, sometimes, you know, we don't know whether we're achieving the highest quality at the least cost and efficiency. So I would invite you to look at 717. It's a bill that I'm sponsoring and will be presenting today. So it isn't an exclusion of the public sector. It's an opportunity for the public sector to be competitive. I don't want to extend this hearing on that subject, Mr. Chairman, but it is the question was asked, is there anything in the works? And there is one. It's not targeting any specific area, ODOT or anything else. It's just creating a process that would require government to evaluate. So I would invite you to look at it, and I would love to visit with you about it.
Chair George, Senator Morse, thank you very much for that. I appreciate that.
I don't know if you folks had a chance to talk with Robin, but one of the things, you know, because I've talked with him for several years now, one of the things that he emphasizes is that this will never work if you don't have buy-in by your employees, that they have to have a vision for making this thing work, and because it will end up. I mean, obviously supervision is going to occur there, but their main desire was to give an opportunity for employees to become employers, and they very meticulous staged event in order to accomplish that. So anyway, did everyone get to testify? I'm sorry I had to run to testify to Bill. Pull the mic over closer to you. Thanks.
Senator George and committee, just want to be very brief here and underline a couple of points very specific to Oregon.
Name for your record, for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chuck Wins, and I'm on the staff of SEIU working with highway workers, ODOT. Thanks. Sorry about that. Just a couple of very quick points here around the privatization issue. One is, as folks know, of course, there's quite a breakdown between the rural and urban in Oregon. So as we look at contractors, potential contractors for doing the highway work, we're looking not only at the Valley and Portland, Salem, down through Eugene, but we're also looking at Bass Junction, Burns, Malheur County, and areas where bid prices theoretically could go very, very high because of the lack of infrastructure out there and the lack of support. I just mentioned that as a factor to consider. Two, ODOT does do efficiency contracting, as both Mr. Slater and Mr. Smidgall mentioned. And usually the efficiency contracting will happen around the use of subcontractors will happen where it's probably cheaper for the agency to go out and have that job provided by the private sector, rather than purchase the capital expenses, add staff, whatever for those jobs. Now, all things being equal, though, ODOT had done a series of feasibility studies, which they owed us by contract. And for quite a number of times, fairly routinely, we would get a response back when these efficiencies were subcontracted that did state that if equipment and manpower was there, it certainly would be cheaper to do it inside the agency rather than sourcing out. Third point I just want to mention is the accountability piece of this. To the extent that ODOT not only does, of course, the highway work, but must do that highway work around environmental regulations, around both public and employee safety issues, around civil rights issues concerning everything from diversity to possibly Bacon-Davis and stuff like that. I think of what would happen to the ODOT infrastructure if they were put in a position of not only needing to, you know, train in-house employees, but also would need to enforce compliance with contract, with regulations out there across numerous contractors. It just seems like a recipe that's designed to, the liabilities remain out there, but much reduce ODOT's span of control on enforcing, following through, and making sure that the job is done there within the context of those regulations. And thank you much.
Chair George, thank you.
Question before you guys leave. This has been something that's intrigued me since I first got here. And is it Svindal?
Svindal. Yeah, John Svindal.
Svindal. I don't know. One of the things that amazed me when it came to maintenance was I can remember asking the former director, what equipment do we have available? And some of you have heard me complain about the fact of a friend of mine that was working for ODOT a few years ago, you know, was sent out to replace guardrail and didn't have any modern equipment, any modern digging or tamping or boring equipment that would be available. And no private contractor would send someone out. The other thing that amazed me that we had no full paving unit. And I asked the question, why don't we have one of those? Because, you know, I was at that time attending a lot of Ritchie Brothers auctions, saw these units selling for very little money, wondering why we didn't have one. Do you feel that you have the equipment that you need in order to do a top-notch job?
We pave every year, and we put a lot of asphalt on the road every year, and we do it with our road grader.
Right.
Is the way we do it.
Right.
And because of the fact that we have to do a lot of patching and we got to do a lot of irregular type of road patching, and some places we do a quarter patch, a half patch, a three-quarter patch, a whole patch. Sometimes we fill just have to do a sunken grade, for instance. I think the equipment that we have is the best versatile for all the different kinds of maintenance that we have to do. It just doesn't sit there. Then when we get done with the paving, we pull our shoulders with it, and we do it throughout the whole district. It gets loaned out to everybody has to sign up for a certain period of time that they get the road grader, so it's being used all the time. In the wintertime, it goes up on the hill and they plow snow with it and cut the pack, and then down here in the summertime, and then we just share things.
One other question. I've had some crew members tell me that, and you kind of touched on it right there, and that's what brought it to my mind, that many times we can get a piece of equipment from a local rental yard available to our crews cheaper than we can get it through the central yard system. And the fact that the delays and actually the cost of doing it. In other words, I can run down to Hertz and rent that thing for X number of dollars, and I've got it right now, and I get it back when I get it back, as compared to working through the process in order to get a piece of machinery out of ODOT Central. Do you find that as a problem?
Sometimes we do rent specialty equipment that we just can't have sitting there waiting for the next job to happen.
Right.
And we'll do that at times. It goes either way, I guess. And it doesn't take long to go down and pick up a machine that's just right for the job that would actually expedite the job if we had it.
So you guys have the authority out in the field to make decisions like that as to expedite a project and rental, or do you have to check through a central?
No, I think we pretty much have, not myself, of course, but through our managers and coordinators that, you know, when we have a specific job that needs to be done, I believe that we have the authority to be able to look at the options and be able to do the right thing, or do the thing that, what I mean by the right thing is do whatever it takes to do the job the cheapest and the quickest and the least expensive to the public.
Very good. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much, Chair George. Members of the committee.
All right, we're going to, while we're staying in more of it, we're going to work this agenda in reverse. And so what we'd like to do now is an agency presentation on access management, because I understand we have some folks that are here visiting, and so if we can, let's do that at this time. Lurie, we'll get back to that in a minute, Kaplan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And thank you for the opportunity to get back with you on access management. This is a follow-up from the meeting last week where I think there was a number of questions and issues that came up on access management. I volunteered to come talk to you about some of the things we do and why we do access management, what we're up to in terms of Division 51, which is our access management permitting process, and then some of the, I think there was questions about metrics. I thought you might want to hear from a real live developer who just went through a process with us in Division 51, where I think we did some things in the city of McMinnville that mm-hmm. worked. And again, it highlights some of the things we're trying to do in the rewrites of the administrative rule on access management. And I'll have Craig here do part of it. I'm going to introduce Jeff Scheich, who is our region manager from Region 2, and then a developer's representative who worked on that particular project. So very quickly, what I'm going to do is just set the stage a little bit for you in terms of access management in general. And as we talked about last time, I wanted to make the committee aware that access management is really an essential element of Oregon's transportation system. And I say that because effective access management really does protect the state's investment while preserving the functional integrity of the highway system and still making it easier for folks to get through and to various parts of the state. In order to talk about access management and what it is, I think we first need to talk about what it really isn't. And under state and federal law, I want to make it clear that ODOT cannot allow a property owner to be landlocked. In other words, we cannot take away all of their access to a public facility, state, county, or city roadway. And if we do, we essentially have to acquire that property under the state or federal rules at fair market value.
What about that piece of property at Six Corners?
Mr. Chairman, I believe you're talking about a piece of property that where access management or access control was purchased as part of the overall project. They do have a full access that allows them to develop commercially off of Tualatin and Sherwood Eady Road, which is the cross street to the state highway.
It would be almost straight across from the last opening into the Safeway?
I believe that's about correct. It's about 250 feet away to the west of the from the intersection of Six Corners.
I wonder, a few years ago, told me that they had no access. Because I asked him, well, what about this? I understand the street's going through, and would you have an access down there? He has been since granted an access. Is it?
That was actually done in 1992. They were given
that
access.
Right?
I think what I'll cover this in a moment. What I think what you're seeing there is they don't believe that is adequate or reasonable access. And that's where we probably disagree, Mr. Chairman, in terms of what is adequate for that property to develop. They want access directly to Highway 99W right at Six Corners. And if you've been in that intersection during rush hours, which I'm sure you have, you know how awful that would be in terms of people trying to do left ins and left outs and so on out of an access on a highway. So I want to make it clear they do have an access. It's on a county road, however. The other thing that I want to clear, just what we just talked about, is that just because we've removed an access, as an example, on a state highway, does not mean they've been landlocked, because they may have another access on that city or county roadway. And in those cases where we do that, and this is exactly the case of that property, we can pay only for the cost of essentially the owners made an investment of the existing driveways on the state highway. And usually as part of the highway reconstruction, we will then reconstruct the new access like we did as part of this project on the county roadway. And I think everybody here knows that if you look at the highway system, it really is the bedrock of not only the state's economy but the national economy. And at some point, everything that we get, and it's in your house probably, arrives by truck. And some of the statistics that you need to think about, on I-5 between Mexico and Canada, the statistics show that at one time or another in that quarter, 25% of the entire imports and exports of the United States are traveling on that I-5 corridor. Now, obviously, that you can see major ports on either end there, but we have some portion of that in the middle. But that just gives you an idea of the reason why that is so important.
Okay.
At the same time,
hang on, we need to pause for a minute. We're having recorder trouble.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. One of these days we'll be all digital. Right. It'll be better budget times. Like one of them died.
Not until we explain the 77 cent chairs.
Yeah.
There's another story. I
don't
know.
Buy anything.
That's right. Oh yes, testing 1, 2, 3. Nope, they're dead.
Sometimes. May have to talk to it.
Yep.
You haven't been following the chair, if you ask for
it? No, I haven't, Mr. Mr. Chairman.
Timing is everything.
Purchase of new chairs is bad timing.
Susan Morgan, Representative Morgan, has a very good explanation of how all that took place and the leaks in the roof and the water and the mold and how this was online to happen, some of the contracting when it was done and the electrical system and the computers that have come on. And we blame it on Representative Cruz's coffee maker overloading the system on the lights and things like that.
I hate to tell you guys, but what we have here is an example of access management. We can't access the system.
I'm the mayor is brand new, and he feels like he's involved in these meetings, so he goes and tells the city council this is what's going on. Something changes, he's not aware, and he feels like it makes him out to be a liar.
Okay.
It doesn't, but that's how he perceives it. And so they need to be very strong. One of the big issues is the utilities. Yeah, they're going to have to Well, we don't know what they have to do. The assumption apparently is that they have to move it, and that's $1 million, and they don't have $1 million. So I suggested that they go to the Economic Development Department for part of that infrastructure money, and I assume it's still there. I don't know. But then if it's buried low enough, they don't have to move it. And then there was discussion about, well, if it's not buried far enough down, can't we just bury it further down? And they were told yes. So there may be some ways around that, but
I think that's consistent with why we're supposed to be capital but I guess the political will issue, right?
They were told that there wasn't money for the entire project. I've got my notes upstairs. They were told there was X amount of dollars, millions of dollars, and it wouldn't cover the whole project, and we didn't know where the rest of the money was coming from. Yes. They don't know what they're okay with is the problem. They wanted a clear understanding of, can the MOU be changed? Is it a legally binding document? And they were told it could be changed. There's another one that comes after that that is legally binding, and they have to go through a real process to change that. The MOU isn't so. I kept saying, well, so you could be more comfortable with this, folks. This is the first one you have to adopt. You can maybe get there and adopt this, knowing that if something goes sideways, you can always, you know, make a change. But there needs to be a lot more communication going on there.
Wow.
But you know, out of about the four or five mayors that I've been with, she was the only one who has been. I mean, engaged, yes, but in terms of supporting.
Yeah, and she can be real lucky, so take that.
Well, we'll end the recess, and we'll resume with Director Warner talking about access management.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. If you remember where I left off, I was just stating how important the interstate system was, and an I-5 in particular for movement of interstate and intrastate goods and services. But at the same time, the highway system is the same system we use to get back and forth from work to school, to pick up the kids, to go to the market, to take the kids to the soccer game. We use those same roadways and highways. They're very important for freight movement, for many, many, many other things. And the other thing that is important for me is I look at the highway system as 90 years of investment by the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, and it's a significant investment. I don't think we really have a good number on what it would take to replace the investment we have today, but it is many, many hundreds of billions of dollars, I would assume, to do what we're talking about. And ODOT is charged by law to maintain and manage this investment, and one of the most cost-effective methods we use is to manage the number of driveways and roads connected to the highway. And the reason we do that is obviously for safety and mobility, but we are very sensitive, as I tried to mention earlier, of the balancing the needs of property owners with, let's say, a log truck trying to get from one city to a mill in another city, or into the next town, or again, for those people who need to commute from one part of the state to the other. If the world was perfect and we had all of the system that we wanted, the city roads, city streets, county roads would take care of those local trips, you know, the trips to the market, trips to the schools, all the things internal within a particular community, and we'd rely on the state highway system to assure the statewide mobility and being able to get from one part of the state to the other. The problem is, throughout the state, many of the state highways try to do both. They try to not only be a main street in a community, but also be that major thoroughfare to move goods and services from one part of the state to the other. And that's often where the conflict is in terms of the function of that highway. The interstate system, and I did mention this to you before, was meant to be a high-speed, again, very uninterrupted traffic flow type of facility. And you could imagine what would happen to that facility if you started adding accesses and traffic signals. You'd lose its viability and effectiveness as a movement of goods for long distances at higher speeds. And I think when you look at the issues confronting access management, we want to maintain the safety of the system. We want to maintain and improve the safety of the system. At the same time, making sure that we're a good partner with the property owners to assure economic development and prosperity can occur in the state of Oregon. On the safety side, when you look at where we are here, this is something we don't think about in terms of access management, but 55% of the accidents that do not occur on the interstate freeway system occur at or near driveways or intersections. Two-thirds of those occur in the urban area, and one-third of those accidents occur in the rural area. And what that means is every week in the state of Oregon, somebody loses their life at an intersection or a driveway to a state highway. And that's very sobering. I think you saw the statistics. 420 people dying in the state of Oregon on our roads and our streets is not what we want to have occur. And every time you add an intersection...
Question, yes. Senator Jukes?
Do you have statistics that separate out, say, a one-lane, two-lane, whatever, versus a fifth lane, a turn lane in there? What are your statistics when you get a turn lane?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't have those at my fingertips, but we definitely do have that data.
Yeah,
put to
I'd
that.
Like to see what a difference, if it makes a difference.
It clearly does, Senator. I think your question is right on, that providing an adequate engineered roadway to deal with the turning movements is how you deal with making those accesses more safe. But it's important to note that for every new intersection on a two-way roadway, whether it's two lanes or four lanes, actually, if it's just a two-lane, if you have unrestricted access right in, right out, left in, left out of that access, you've created, from the traffic engineer's perspective, 9 conflict positions.
Yeah, no, so, I understand all that. Yeah. You were just giving the drastic statistics that I wanted to see, because most of the ones I'm involved in, that's what people are asking for, is the
right. Right. And I'll try to get you some additional data on that, because I think it's important. All I'm trying to say is, if you look at that, every one of those intersections or driveways is a potential conflict, and obviously that's where we have many, many accidents, in fact the majority of them off of the interstate highway system.
Bruce, I need to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You're talking about overall accident rates, because if you go downtown Salem, for example, you don't have a state highway there. Well, there's a couple of them I can think of, but the bulk of them are not, and yet you have all that conflict there, and the bulk of the accidents are going to occur in those areas. Is that state highway only numbers?
Mr. Chairman, the numbers I'm giving you are for the state highway system only.
Most states that I've been in are doing something completely different. I can give you a perfect example of what works, and that's McMinnville. If you look, we came in and we put the bypass Highway 18, and we basically gave 99 to the city of McMinnville. I mean, it's still, state highway, but it is basically a bypass, and that has become a local access road. Now, that has worked, and I appreciate, for example, out on Highway 18 trying to protect that to make sure that we have that functioning as a highway that's on its way to the coast. So that is important, but to me, the key, what seems where we seem to be falling down, is there's no movement to get the bypasses built where they're needed. We just seem to find that impossible to do, and even though we know the safety is overwhelmingly going to be out on a freeway type of a highway, the freight and the cars are going to be moving faster. It's an economic development issue for the coast or for the east side. I mean, when are we going to start thinking that way? Because we can constrict for what we're doing. You're making it inconvenient for folks out in the we're making it inconvenient for the folks, and we're affecting business. And I think we're looking at right now economic consequences affecting business. Most businesses, particularly big box, are operating on very, very, very small margin. They've got to have the proper exchange of people. And I have many of them. We're going to have an example of maybe one that worked, but that was an amazing process they had to go through and to get to where they were trying to get with Lowe's. But the other thing is that we know overall the impact has been negative to business. I had too many of them in my area that have been hurt. So, but address, if you would, for me, an idea of doing what other states are doing, and that is getting the bypasses and giving our downtowns back to our cities. What I found with McMinnville is they prospered under that scenario. That old 99 has a very prosperous business location now, and we can bypass the highway if we'd like. I mean, bypass the city.
Mr. Chairman, excellent point, because what that shows in McMinnville, as an example, is a facility, the old highway, because of the access points, because of the signals, was losing its ability to move people greater distances and from the Portland area to the coast. And so there was a hue and cry from the residents that we need another facility around that town. And I agree that the bypass there has done a marvelous job, and I think that probably the community is much better off as a result of that traffic not being going right through the middle of downtown McMinnville. Same thing in Bend. We've now built our second bypass in Bend because we didn't manage the did not manage the access and the number of signals on the first bypass. And what you're saying is if we had the money to do all of the bypasses that people want us to do, I would remind you the price tag on the Bend bypass was a little over $100 million. Mm-hmm. The latest price tags I've heard on the Newburgh-Dundee transportation improvement project are approaching $200 million.
Right.
So you can see that you start talking about the money that's available for modernization right now of $52 million a year. If you did no other improvement projects in the entire state of Oregon, you could probably do one bypass every 2 years.
But I want you to back me up to the other number, and that is $50 million is a nice number, and I've griped about that since I've been here. It's a ridiculous number. And what ODOT has tried to eliminate that and make it zero, I've objected to that continually. But the main thing is that the overall all funds coming in is $3.25 billion. And what I'm saying is that we've got to realize that if you have a certain amount of money that's being dedicated to a operation, and we've seen as we've gone down through the budgets, we've looked at a lot of kind of operations within ODOT. If we don't ever look to streamline those and make those more efficient and then figure out what we can eliminate and not, we're never going to get the money to that. And I think this state will reap the whirlwind when it comes to economic recovery. We just will not recover without an infrastructure that's going to deliver. So anyway, excuse me, I'm preaching to...
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only comment I would make, if I could, Senator, is obviously you are the Ways and Means Committee. You're going to be looking at our budget and telling us if we're spending our dollars in the appropriate areas. When you look at our budget, the vast majority of our dollars do go to maintain and preserve the system we have today. That is true. And I think if you want to make trade-offs about what pieces of the system we don't want to maintain at the level we're maintaining it now to put more money in modernization, we can do that. I think the problem is we've also realized there's some other big demands in terms of bridges and things that we need to get to, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk to you about our funding package sometime in the near future that may address some of those needs and get to some of the areas that you're very much referring to right there. Sorry.
I just wanted to ask how much ODOT has spent so far on the Newburgh-Dundee bypass.
Since 1947.
And the reason I ask that is a few years ago I asked for a number on what you spent, on the Astoria bypass. And it's been a few years since then, and actually you had done a little bit. You haven't done anything in the last couple of years, except say no. But at that point it was over $2 million. So we're spending a lot of money, actually, on these things. Mm-hmm. If you add them all up, we're just not producing anything. I mean, the environmental impact statement is now expired on the Astoria bypass, so if you want to do that project, you got to start all over. And I don't know where yours is, but,
yeah,
I mean, we are. We're encouraging communities to believe that we can go down the path that Senator George is talking about, and we meet with them, and we do the studies, and we spend a fair amount of money. We just don't ever get there.
Well, Mr.
Except
Chairman...
maybe over in Bend, which I understand they now want the third bypass. I have to tell you what I think about them getting a third before some of us get a first.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, your points are all very well taken. I mean, what it really says, first off, is I think, 10 years ago, we made some commitments and led people to believe that if we got started on their project, the money would be there to finish the project. And quite frankly, we were looking at some of the revenue projections that had occurred during the 80s and early 90s, which obviously there was no increases for almost a decade, as you know, in terms of new money. So we undertook, a decade ago, a number of studies. Quite frankly, if we knew what we knew now, we would never embark on those.
But this goes back further than that. Astoria Bypass is the oldest project you have in ODOT that hasn't been completed. And if yours goes back to 47, you're right there with us.
Yeah.
time. So, I mean, these are...
Right. What my desire, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, my desire and what we're trying to do is I believe we're getting much better at project delivery as a result of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. We're doing a lot of things differently, and Senator Morris, being a contractor, understands we're doing a lot more design builds. We're looking at innovative partnerships like we never have, and frankly, we're working on ways to streamline those environmental and land use processes so we can get through those much more quickly, because we have learned, we have stumbled on some of these projects, but it's my desire to move those projects along as quickly as possible, and once we make a commitment to a project, we need to make sure we have money to build it and move it towards construction and implementation quickly. So I'm right with you on all of these. I think we're going to run out of time here.
That's
if we don't. Let me talk to you about closures and compensation issues, which are some of the areas you got into last week. When ODOT does a modernization project or a safety project, we do organize a team of folks, usually mostly ODOT, but we involve local governments, to look at the safety issues and operational issues and accesses that are impacted by any particular project. And these teams look at ways to make driveways, existing driveways and accesses safer, but sometimes, as a result of the designs and the need to improve it, driveways will need to be closed. And this practice has been in place for about 3 years now, and I think one of the frustrating things for you and for me is we built a number of projects since 1949, which is when the legislature said we needed to start permitting driveways. We built new accesses and driveways over that same time period and didn't permit them ourselves. And because of that, what that means, when we go through and close one of those driveways that maybe we even built, the courts and our attorney general have said we cannot compensate property owners for the loss of that particular access. They believe, and the courts have concluded and upheld, that this is just part of ODOT's regulatory authority that, quite frankly, has been granted to the department by the legislature. And the courts have consistently upheld this position. The second issue is we do now permit driveways on our projects, and also when anybody makes application for an access, they are given a permit. And Senate Bill 86, which you passed in 1999, allows ODOT to spend money on administrative remedies as a result of closures of legally permitted driveways to the state highway system. And I think this was really good, and this has allowed property owners and us to negotiate and deal with individual closures where the driveway was legal and permitted. And typically these the costs involve out-of-pocket expenses to redo accesses, one of the things you need to be aware of, this law will sunset in January of 2004 unless it's re-upped. We believe it's a law that should be re-upped, and we're going to be working with the transportation committees to make sure that gets taken care of this legislative session. And then finally, the other area which I you probably have heard conversations and discussions of, a reservation of access. This is where my department has in the past gone out or currently buying right away for a highway project, and they've reserved a portion or a section of that frontage on the highway for access for that particular property. That is a deeded access for that property, and we cannot take that away without going through an eminent domain process. And there has been a number of court cases that have helped refine our thinking. But essentially, the compensation gets down to a before and after. If you remove the access, what's the impact on the value of that property? And that is how we start out with our estimates of what need to be done, and then ultimately is the basis where we go into condemnation if we need to. But those are areas we definitely need to go through condemnation or have a willing seller. So that gives you a real quick picture of why we do access management, some of the issues regarding closure and compensation. What I'd like to do now is turn it over to Mr. Greenleaf and tell you a little bit about Division 51, the requirements that you gave us, what we've done to address those requirements, and I think some of the things we're trying to do to make the system better for Oregon and for property owners wanting access to our highways.
Thank you, Carter.
Bruce, I want to put something else on your mind in terms of speaking of vision. What's the vision for Fremont Bridge area? I mean, I'm just crazy every day of my life because there are three lanes there, four in spots, and people going to Beaverton fill up all three lanes, and those of us that are trying to go the thruway to get back on the freeway cannot get over, because all three lanes are fueled by those people that are trying to get on the Beaverton Exchange.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, if I understand your question properly, you're regarding after you go over the Fremont Bridge heading southbound on I-405, you want to head towards the west side of the Portland metro area on Highway 26. You have to move over a lane before you go through the tunnels, right?
I want to keep straight.
You want to keep going southbound on
I want to keep going southbound, but all the three lanes are cluttered with people going to Beaverton.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, Senator, I understand your issue. That's what I thought it was. And if you're driving by that location right now, you'll see a lot of construction going on. I don't know whether you've noticed that on the off ramp 226. The intent is to add another lane for the exiting in that area to allow more cars to go through there and not stack up on I-405. We don't know that that's going to be a complete solution, but it should help dramatically from what's there today. So if you're interested in that project, I'd be glad to have Gary Magger come.
I'm very
interested
in that
project.
Okay,
thank you. We'll have somebody brief you on what we're doing there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Craig Greenleaf from the Transportation Development Division at ODOT. During the 99 session that Bruce made reference to earlier, that was also the time when Senate Bill 773 was passed, and that bill directed the agency to develop administrative rules related to access management issues. We did that by forming an advisory committee, advisory committee that spent more than a year of time trying to advise us about how to best put together an access management rulemaking. In February of 2000, ultimately, the commission adopted administrative rules related to access management, and they did that with an effective date of April of that year. When the commission adopted those administrative rules, they gave the department specific direction to come back and evaluate those administrative rules in about 15 months. They wanted to have basically a year's of experience of trying to look at what was happening with those administrative rules. Obviously, in many cases, these represented changes of direction or nuances and details that hadn't been in administrative rule form before. And the commission was keenly interested in whether or not, as originally envisioned, these rules were operating. We did conduct that evaluation. We reconvened the Access Management Advisory Committee, and we undertook the experiential look at how the rules had worked. We found in some cases they had worked, in some cases they hadn't worked, and we tried to then formulate on a revision to those administrative rules to try and attack those problems that have continued to be around for us. One of the fundamental complaints that we got is, my goodness, these are complicated and difficult to understand. So as we've undertaken the revision to those rules, we have almost cut them in half as to the proposal that's now out for public hearing and review. That we're just underway with the beginning processes of actually going through a revision to those administrative rules, and we have the proposal that has been developed based upon the committee's recommendation is actually to reduce the extensive character in some areas and remove and reorder in some cases just to be able to make the use of the rules work more smoothly. Other things that we're trying to accomplish with those is just making sure that the engineering discretion that may be necessary in order to come to appropriate answers are working. The clarification of the timeline issues where there have been uncertainties about those. Then also looking at the sort of the trigger mechanisms and the threshold considerations for how the rule works. And in those cases where we're trying to support things like the infill and further development along various parts of the system that are already largely in a developed condition, we've tried to improve the flexibility for being able to deal with those infill and redevelopment conditions, and often, quite frankly, that's what's happening as we deal with access management questions. We're dealing with an area that has a certain pattern of development that's being redeveloped and changed. In some cases, the consolidation of properties that have been in multiple ownerships and a lot of other things that ultimately we're trying to be able to make work in a much more effective way. There are a number of other clarification points that we're trying to seek through the administrative rule. I can go through those in some more detail if you wish, but I think the fundamental thrust of what we're trying to accomplish with this is continue on with the agenda of safety and consideration for all the points that Bruce raised earlier, but recognize that this is something that impacts communities, and we have to be careful about how we put the rules together in a way that doesn't inappropriately stifle development, doesn't delay our decision-making or whatever. So that's been the broad outline of what we've been trying to accomplish, and that's essentially what the revised form of these administrative rules is attempting to accomplish in very large part. We previously provided you with some information about how we're doing with respect to the database of permit decisions that we have. And we indicated to you that in very large part we find approvals through the decisions that we do make. And 96% of the cases we're actually getting to an approved condition. When people do make a choice to appeal, either by taking that to a region review process or other more formal review proceedings, they in some cases are concerned about conditions or mitigation issues that have been addressed in the permit. In some cases, they're ultimately concerned about the denial or some other aspect of the review. Those reviews have resulted in some cases in reversal of the original decision that the department made. 5 out of the 33 cases where that's happened, we've actually reversed the original decision that we've made. We've also tried to be attentive about the issue of timeline. And if you look at the average time for those permits that have actually reached decision, the average permit time for us is 42 days. So the vast majority of cases, we're actually moving them through. The complicated cases, and you're going to hear some detail about one of the complicated cases that we dealt with just recently in just a few moments, but those have taken longer. But we do put a premium on trying to make decisions in as prompt a manner as we possibly can, and we hold that as an important consideration and are trying hard to live up to that expectation. I think with that, I'd like to have some folks maybe just give you a closer up look at some of the details of a specific case. So I'd be also able to answer any questions that you might have about my part of the.
Yeah, I'd like to have Mr. Scheidt come up and go over what I think was an example of a project where we learned that we needed to do some revisions to our rule.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the committee. For the record, I am Jeff Scheich. I am the region manager for the Northwest region of ODOT, and it's a privilege to be here this morning. Thank you for your time. I'm here today to share with you the work that ODOT did within the city of McMinnville concerning a Lowe's Home Improvement Center improvement project that involved the state highways. And I'd like to impart with you a picture that I see, that this is a win-win picture for not only for ODOT and the city, but definitely also for the developer as well. The results I saw from this project is that it was a creation of 175 to 200 jobs for the local community, obviously an influx of a lot of revenue into the local area. I think the local paper said it was an increase of about $18 million. For ODOT, what we saw is that this project led to the first in the state of an access management plan that was adopted not only by ODOT, but also by the city of McMinnville as well. And I'll speak to that a little bit. But as a result of all this work, we've been able to reach a place that I think is very good for all parties involved. And with your permission, I did bring some posters, and if you don't mind, I'd like to stand and talk off of that, if it's okay with the committee.
Pick up the mic as you go, Jeff.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to kind of do the game show thing.
That's right.
Bear with me, please. First off, the location to speak from here is the city of McMinnville. We have three state highways here. First off is Highway 18 that runs east and west. North goes up on our map this time. And Highway 99W running basically north-south. Salem would be down this direction, or excuse me, Rickrell and those communities would be down this way. Highway 99W heading into McMinnville. And then the Highway 18 connector. This location, as you can see, there's a lot of open land in here. There's about 60 acres of land that is potentially available for development. It's also located, as you can see, that Highway 18 is an expressway facility. So we're within the confines of, by Division 51, a interchange management area. And that's defined by being about a quarter mile from the end of a ramp defines that location. The size of this for this interchange management area would go from the end of the ramps here basically up to this intersection right here of Old Sheridan Road and Highway 99W. It would also entail this part of the wedge as well. It's basically this big triangular area would be the interchange area. So the Rice property, Mr. Rice is the property owner. The Rice Furniture Store is right down in this location next to Highway 99W. The other key properties to mention is that there are manufacturer home sale lots located here, here, and here. There is also the EDS location right here with an access right there to the state highway. The manufactured home sale lots, these things are now vacant, but there is an existing manufactured home residences down in this location right here. Booth Bend Road is a key east-west connector into all this as well. I'll speak to that as well. The developer, and Mr. Rice, the developer, Mr. Roodhouse, I'll introduce in a minute, and the Lowe's Departments, Lowe's Home Improvement Store, wanted to build the Lowe's store down right in here, as well as then the Rice Furniture Store. They wanted to do a major expansion, redevelopment of their store right in this location as well. And so when they came to us last year, their original proposal is that they were looking for three private accesses. One along the Highway 18 connector, pretty close to the EDS location. Another one that was fairly close to where Booth Bend Road intersects 99W. And then another private access a little bit to the south of Booth Bend Road. And because of with the rule of Division 51 and that these were private accesses, we were in a place that we could not accept that proposal. We heard very clearly from Lowe's, the city, the county, the key constituents here, that they really wanted to strive for a solution here to make this work. And so ODOT, we went back to the table and said, what could we do to make this happen? And so what it came to is that we needed to, instead of thinking about these as private road connections, is start looking at this from a public road connection viewpoint. And that required the engagement of the city. It also required is that for getting this done is that we develop an access management plan with an adoption by the city as well as ODOT. And so I'd like to go into the specifics of those improvements. First off, is I'd like to share with you the short-term improvements. These are improvements that were done as part of the project, as Lowe's is putting in the store right now. Should also mention is that Lowe's is making very good progress. Their store should be open, I believe, sometime this summer. The Rice Furniture Store down here also will be open within maybe a month or so. So very good progress there. The short-term improvements, and these improvements are being paid by the developer and the property owners, are as follows. First off, there is the extension of Booth Bend Road. There is no road previously that goes from Highway 99W to Highway 18. This would be a new road that's being put in right now. It is a three-lane facility, one lane each direction and a turning lane. And this road then dead ends into Highway 18, right across from the access for EDS. And we create a traffic signal right here. We'll have a new traffic signal right here as well. And then we have all three of the signals. We call it interconnecting. Basically, is that the signals can talk to each other so that they can all operate as one system. So this road will be coming in as part of the project. We've also worked with the Rice property owners that we have dedicated right-of-way along the west side of Highway 99W, and I'll explain the long-term reasons for that. We've also worked that we'd have access control, dedicated access control, also along 99W along the Rice property front. Those are the basic short-term improvements that are going in as part of the cost of the developing of this location. Now, the nice thing about this access management plan that was adopted by the city this fall, and it's being adopted by the Oregon Transportation Commission at their meeting next week, I'm projecting that, but we are confident we have a very good plan here. We're basically outlining, you saw right just in the previous slide, the short-term improvements that are going in. And I'm going to share with you the long-term improvements that are being adopted in these plans. And this is a blueprint as development occurs within this entire area that will guide decisions for the city or also guide decisions for ODOT as well. So for the long-term investments, and again, these things will happen as new development proposals come into the area. There's no exact timeline for any of these things to come in place. They're just adopted and formally recognized. And so the things that will happen in here, if you can see up here, we have orange are the short-term things that I've spoke of already. The blue things here highlight some of the long-term improvements, and those are the ones I'll highlight right now. You'll see in here is that several of the intersections at Old Sheridan Road up here, Highway 99W and Keck Drive, as well as Booth Bend Road, is that there'll be intersection improvements, basically adding turning lanes to make the intersections handle the amount of traffic that could be coming through. There will also be widening of Highway 99W from Old Sheridan Road down through past the Highway 18 interchange location down here, basically building a five-lane section with a center turning lane is what will be going through here.
Well, I'm going to be paying for the blue part of this.
Some of these are paid by the developer when they come in with a proposal. Some of these things will be paid in cooperation with the city. Some of it would be paid by ODOT. And it's one of those things that when the proposals come up is that the discussions and the negotiations are worked through.
It's going to work through well so Mr. Rice won't be mad with us.
Well, Chair Rice is already mad with you, but and that's the question: were Rice is paid for that access, or part of the deal to get the development? Did they surrender that right away, right in front of the store, of the current store?
Chair George and Senator Carter, first off, working with Mr. Rice has been very good experience for us. He's been very, very engaging and very accommodating. Part of the negotiations for the short-term improvements I highlighted was that dedicated right-of-way is already placed here. He's agreed to that, and that is when we get into a place of widening the road, if or when we get to that stage. So that is dedicated, as well as the access control along here, as well as along here as well. So those things are in place, and that was part of the negotiations. as terms of exactly when the full access control particularly would happen on the east side of 99W, again, is when there is the change in the change in land use for these specific properties, and that negotiation would happen. So we would have to, we'd be working that cooperatively with the city. Another key ingredient of this is that Booth Bend Road would be widened, and that there would be a new north-south connector from Keck Drive down to Booth Bend Road that would also be developed. Again, some of these pieces are picked up by development, some of these pieces by the city, some of these things by ODOT, and we would work through those hand in hand.
Okay.
And just very quickly, then, this just shows how the access control would look like. The purple shows the existing access control facilities. The orange is the short-term things that are already negotiated in place. And the blue are the long-term things that will happen over time with development proposals. And thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions.
Your question from Representative Silver. Mr. Chair, it's more of a comment. I can tell I am definitely not asking for enough. Because in Heppner, all we wanted was a slow down sign as you come into town. And I have to tell you, the department was fantastic in giving us our slow down sign.
You sit on the right committee. You'll get a sign. But did you have to pay for the sign?
I'm not sure. Thank you for letting me indulge.
Chair George, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce Alan Rudehouse, who is the president of EPS Development and the developer for the Lowe's project, to offer a few comments.
Great. Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, Alan Rudehouse, president, RPS Development Company, McMinnville. And it's a pleasure to be here and comment on a public agency that we have to deal with. I've never had this opportunity before, but it is a pleasure. To put in context a little bit my remarks, I've been in the shopping center development business, private business, for 25 years. I've done a number of projects in a number of states, and I've worked with a lot of agencies, and sometimes very closely. I've done three redevelopment projects, one with the city of Santa Barbara, one with San Francisco, one with Napa. I'm working on one right now in Kaiser. And so I do have a perspective on dealing with public agencies and quite a bit of experience. I am here to speak very highly about ODOT this morning. And I realize the issues that you're dealing with, both budget and rulemaking, et cetera, and the constituencies out there, it's a very complex situation, and my remarks are actually fairly simple. I'm not here to try to make a suggestion on how to solve a lot of those. But what we found in a difficult context was that the personnel at all levels of ODOT are trying to get a difficult job done, and they have been accommodating to the private sector in coming up with solutions. Did we get everything we wanted in McMinnville? No. Did we get reasonable access that our project can flourish under? Yes. And it wasn't easy to get there. It took longer than we would have liked it to take. We as a group, Lowe's, Rice, ourselves, are footing the bill. But frankly, in the context of the way things are done today, I don't see what the alternative was. As you're well aware, there isn't money in the state budget to accommodate private development in this fashion. So the fact that the project is going forward on schedule speaks to the issue of whether or not it could afford the costs. I'd also like to comment on two other projects that I wasn't asked to, but this is the third major project I've been involved with it with ODOT. We had one in Gresham 3 or 4 years ago that involved a very difficult solution to a horrendous traffic problem. ODOT was very creative on that one. I won't go into the details, but it couldn't have been done without ODOT. Their open-mindedness about solving the problems. And then more recently, another project in McMinnville involved Walgreens. Pretty small routine project, but in the middle of a state highway to the one-way couplet right at the south end of Baker and Adams. And there were some tricky issues, and it took some hard work by ODOT and accommodation by them to, again, give the private sector what it had to have. There was some give and take on both sides. But even with all the experience I've had with public agencies, I'd rank ODOT very high on the list. And they are working hard, and I look forward to working with them again. I know we'll have arguments and negotiations, and there'll be some tough meetings, but that's just part of the process. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Alan, I saw some county commissioners that sweat blood and used some unusual language about that whole project, so it's good to see it come to fruition. The other question that I have is, how much are you and Rice going to have invested in purchasing public, building public right-of-way? I mean, this is going to be a city street on that couplet. How many dollars are you going to have?
I think in round numbers it's $2 million.
Yeah.
The way it's distributed between Rice, Lowe's, and ourselves is really sort of indeterminate because when you put a cost over here, it means you can pay less over here. By that I mean, although Lowe's has done the work and funded the project, they paid less for the land than they would have if those costs hadn't been in there. So in that way, the Rice family contributed as well. So it's a significant cost. The things that I would like to see improved upon are the time that it takes to get to answers. And I'm gratified to hear that there's a real effort underway to streamline and improve the way Division 51 rules work, because I think that the need for the extraordinary cooperation that occurred in McMinnville was generated in large part by the inflexibility of the rules. So I'm happy to see that, and I know I'll face the issue again, so I hope it works more smoothly next time.
Well, I've noticed over the last couple of years that I've seen the projects speed up, and I think I can probably point to a reason that is happening. But and that's a very, very good thing, because I mean, we had the Walgreens in Newburgh that I thought was a bottomless pit that we'd never get out of, and all of a sudden things began to happen, and we have a successful business existing there right now, and people went from being very distressed and very unhappy to being very pleased with the results. So I think there is movement, which is very, very beneficial, particularly when our businesses are hurting right now. This is tough times. These are tough times. Yes, Senator Carter.
I wanted to ask the other gentleman that made a presentation along with Mr. Roodhouse. And I understand the challenges, and you made that very clear, that it was in coming to some agreement on these projects, but would you say for the most part that you and Mr. Rice and others that have worked with ODOT at the end of the day, can you say you're happy, or that if you're not joyfully happy, but you're pleasingly happy in terms of the direction in which you're going and the cooperation that you got from ODOT?
The nature of the relationship between developers and public agencies that have the right and responsibility of granting permits, I don't think I'd ever characterize with the words happy or joyous. they're basically an adversarial relationship, as well they should be. You know, taking off my developer hat, putting on my citizen hat, they're out there trying to protect the interests of a much broader constituency than just people who want to do something on a particular piece of property of an economic nature. Having said that, I would unqualifiedly say, in the three major episodes that I've had with ODOT over the years, that they have been highly professional, consistent in their application of the rules and regulations that they operate under, and that in each case I have gotten what I deserved under the circumstances. And that means I'm satisfied. Just happy is a word I
Okay, are you satisfied? I'm a counselor. You know, those are the words I use.
Not a developer.
Enthusiastic.
Right.
I'm happy when I go home at night.
I know that.
See my family.
That's right. That's a great one to do. Yeah. And I'd like to ask someone from the department, in terms of the neighbors and other business enterprises along the stretch that you've had to work with, would you think, and I'm going back to your performance objectives and in terms of the kind of satisfaction that ODOT has received, which was, I thought, pretty high. Would you say that if I were to go in that community today, that people there for the most part would find that ODOT, though challenging and though questioning and this kind of stuff, is reasonably satisfied with the relationship in preparing this project?
Chair George, Senator Carter, I would say is that from the constituents that I've heard from, the city, the county, Mr. Rice, a thank you letter that we've received from Lowe's Corporation, that I sense a high level of satisfaction with the outcome here, that they see from citizens' viewpoints that we've done good things for safety in this effort, but we've also tried to address some economic opportunities also for the local area. There's probably a few who may not all share that great optimism, but I think a majority would.
That's closer to day things are okay in that community. In terms of
Chair George, Senator Carter, yes, ma'am.
That's what I need to hear.
Representative Krieger and then Senator Morris.
Chair, I'm going to wait until Bruce gets back up.
Okay. Oh, okay. Jeff, before you... you know what? Bruce can answer this question. That'll be fine. Thanks. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of... He took care of the problem so well, I almost forgot about it. That was yeah, really. Well, I got one of these.
A year ago, we wouldn't have been so happy.
You know, the Coquille Mill site, where the mill was shut down, the GP, and I think 90, it sat there for 10 and a half years and back and forth, trying to get an access to it, and there were some issues with DEQ and Division of State Lands because of water and toxic things from the old mill, and they finally worked their way through that, but really, something happened about the time Bruce came on board about these type of issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to blow his horn for him, but that community and you know, the city council, the city fathers were just totally frustrated because every time they come to the bargaining table, the goalposts have been moved. And we brought that to Bruce's attention. And I think it was about 6 months, and then they've got the access, they got the new light in, they got the lanes, they got Bi-Mart coming, and I just want him to address how that came about, as far as why were you able to do it and it couldn't happen the first 10 years.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I'm not going to take responsibility for getting it done quickly, but I will take responsibility for making it clear to my staff that they needed to resolve it, they needed to work with the community, and they needed to get on with the project that had been discussed for a long time, and to quit arguing about some of the small things, but get the project, get the accesses built so that area can develop. And get beyond some of the small issues, frankly, that were I think tearing all of us apart, that had to do with widths of sidewalks or how we were going to build a retaining wall. And I said, this is ridiculous. So when I gave the direction to the staff to get on with the project and get it done, what you saw in my staff, the region manager in that area and the area managers, others, took it to heart and actually worked a little bit more closely in a partnership way with the community than they had before. I think timing's everything. I happened to come in when things were at the point where they needed to just be told to move forward, and that's what really is, I think, the difference in that one. Overall, what I think you're seeing here, and I'm very pleased with the remarks that you just heard, but as I said before, we're not all the way there yet. We're doing a good job of learning. Division 51 with this project pointed out some severe deficiencies in the administrative rule. It was inflexible. In fact, there was nothing we could say except no on this project, And I think I and my staff felt that was unacceptable because it was an opportunity. As a result of the learning here, I think you'll see, for the reasons that Craig identified in his presentation, a rule that will allow us to get these kind of things resolved much more quickly. They may end up with the same result, but the timeline will be much more quick, which is, I think, one of the big things that the development community really places a high value on is time, because that is money for folks. I hope I answered your question, Mr. Creer.
Yeah, you did. We just appreciate that you're making things happen, and that mindset of finding solutions comes down to your people and your agency, service to the community.
That's why it's called leadership. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the presentation because obviously you're put in a position of sometimes being asked to do the impossible, and then we hear that. But I'm wondering if there's a public policy issue here, and it occurs to me that a longstanding problem we had in Albany in the Bermuda Triangle, some people call it, with Geary and 99 Pacific and St. Anne, where you had, by good reasons from a traffic engineering perspective, one access to a property that has joint ownership. So the part of the property that didn't have the access was held hostage by the property that did have the access. And in the sake of fairness, and you know, needing to get projects moved forward, I'm wondering what kind of public policy issue that we might address as a legislative body that would preserve the equity of both parties but not allow one to become abusive in the solution to getting access to property for development.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, excellent project. I can tell you've been involved in the development game a bit, because what you saw in this project and others the successful ones involve the private sector, the local governments, and the state, especially if they involve state highways, city streets, and obviously the cities and counties are the people responsible for land use. We need to work very closely with the local folks to assure that when land use approvals are given, some of those issues are taken care of and requirements placed on the development that don't place other folks hostage in terms of a negotiating posture when they want to move forward with the development on our side. In other words, providing reciprocal agreements and so on and those things. I think we're also being much better at identifying those opportunities so that during the land use approval process for one party to a joint access, we make sure that the provisions are made to allow the other property owner to take advantage of that. What it says is in some of those cases we also need to be creative and frankly maybe give temporary accesses to the other side because they may not be able to come agreement with the other private party, that then through the land use process when one or both of them have an opportunity to develop, we can then consolidate those access points at a later date. In other words, make incremental improvements to get to the right solution. And that's again what you see here is the rule said we had to have all or nothing, and what we found out is there's a lot of things we could do that make the situation a lot better now and in the future, but aren't the perfect solution for what if we had a blank slate. And as you know, that's the trouble. We're usually dealing with something that's partially developed and another piece of bare property or redevelopment, and those are the ones where it really becomes interesting and contentious. And the question is, am I answering your question, Senator?
Well, I guess my encouragement would be, and it probably could be done through administrative rule, maybe through your department, to make sure that when you have one access to multiple properties and you don't have willing cooperative ventures, that somehow that those persons that are held hostage in that situation have some kind of redress to do what they need to do to move forward. And
Mr. Chair,
you would have the background certainly to deal with that from a land use standpoint, but
very valid.
Mr. Chairman, Craig Greenleaf again. Senator Morris, I believe that you've hit upon one of the real conundrums that often accompanies development actions, and I think Bruce hit the main thrust of the primary way you handle those things is that securing the land use approvals in a way that allows the access management questions to be resolved simultaneously with the land use approvals is something that we've worked hard to accomplish, and some 75% of the cases that we deal with in access management actually have their origin out of a land use proceeding of some kind or another. They don't come to us as a sort of independent act. They come tied together to some extent. We need to be more effective as we participate in pre-application conferences with the local governments at the point that they conduct those kinds of reviews. We need to actually have people come in and talk with the department in pre-application conferences about our work on access management more frequently than we probably do today. I think we do need to try and make sure that we participate effectively with those parties at the point local comprehensive plans are being developed or rezoning actions or conditional use permits are being authorized through the land use planning process in order for us to be able to put many of those agreements in place and not have the sort of unbalanced condition that you're describing, because that often puts the department in a very awkward place. It puts the various property owners in an awkward place, and it isn't a situation that we ought to be trying to encourage. I think we're trying to make sure that the work that we do inside the administrative rules help support that condition and don't create circumstances that create that sort of unbalanced playing condition.
Mr. Chairman, sir, if you have some ideas, I'd love to chat with you some more also on this.
Let me ask this question, because, you know, the property that I mentioned before, which is the Springbrook at 99, that's exactly the condition that they're in. The city has suggested in ODOT. Well, let me just back up and describe the situation. When we redid Highway 99, we put in sidewalks where sidewalks didn't exist and basically put in a blockade and eliminate a lot of access. And the access to that piece of property, we used to just drive off of the gravel at the hamburger stand and get out on the road. Now you can't get there because it's a big concrete barrier sitting there between you. The suggestion was that he go to the unfriendly landowner next door and negotiate for that access. Well, that isn't going to happen. My question is this: do we have any sort of authority to go in and if it's necessary to condemn that in order to provide a mutual access, you know, for both property owners in order to resolve that conflict? Because, you know, I'm going to use the word Bermuda Triangle. I've referred to it as a black hole, but I mean certain properties that get isolated. Is that possible? Do we have the authority to actually intervene in order to, because we're talking about economic development here.
Mr. Chair, let me start this. Maybe Craig can follow up further. Clearly, if the need is there, if we're in a place where we're landlocking a property, one of the options of buying a property is doing exactly what you describe, and we've done that before, I believe, provide joint access to various properties. Again, as Craig and I had mentioned earlier, if that adjacent property came in for a land use and redevelopment proposal and we had an opportunity to comment and knew that this was an issue, we'd be looking for those very kinds of opportunities to consolidate driveways, provide driveways at a safer location. So that's one of the big methods by which we encourage local government. You've got to have using the local government's authority, quite frankly, through the land use decision to be able to mandate those type of things. But usually local governments are more than willing to work with us when we see those kind of issues.
Mr. Chairman, I think the use of condemnation authority is something that is at the far edge of the way we handle things, and it certainly isn't the first place we go to try and resolve a problem like that. As we work with the Attorney General's office about when it's appropriate to use condemnation authority and under what circumstances, and making sure that in the pursuit of that we're doing things that are very specifically highway related and that we haven't somehow abridged the constitutional responsibilities that we have in the pursuit of those kinds of things, it's a very narrow field, and that's sort of the last resort, if you will, of solving the problem.
Well, you know, let me get to Representative Smith, and then we'll come back to Senator Morris. Or are you just leaving?
I need to leave.
Thanks. Because I intervened. Okay, go ahead.
Please, yeah.
Yes.
Excuse me. If you have a situation where you have multiple ownership and one party is really, I mean, just impossible, could you, by administrative rule, and this would become a really, you know, come to the table type of a rule that would allow you to move that access to the property, you know, if it's engineering feasible, to the property that is wanting development, that would force the other party to come to the table to a mutual. I mean, it would just flip the tables Just as a
good suggestion. I understand what you're saying.
I think that's worth looking at, looking for, because what I worry about, and Senator Carter's not here to agree with me on this, is that I know the folks, the big developers, the Lowe's and the rest of them, they can seem to work through this process. Who seems to be caught is the small landowner. That, you know, like, for example, as I said, they'll tell the property when the redevelopment occurred, thought, my goodness, you know, now my wife and I can live out the rest of our days with some sort of prosperity, only to find out that, nope, under the new rules, you're landlocked. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. First of all, let me applaud you again for your work. Representative Krieger raised a valid point in that sometimes you forget about the work you do because it went smoothly. Case in point is I had a very small community, about 180 citizens, that was putting together a city park, and with nothing more than one phone call, they were able to get the appropriate signage they needed to identify the park off of a state highway. So I do compliment you. It's not only large projects, it's small as well. I also point out for the committee and for the record, just really quick, I do have a potential conflict of interest, as I do work with clients who work with the department in seeking funding. Now, with that said, are there partnership opportunities between the state and local government, for example, in bulk purchasing opportunities? I'm visualizing rural Eastern Oregon, and quite often you have a state highway that connects into the county highway, and when the state comes to town to do a project, it's a big event. Mm-hmm. And quite often I would think that there would be an opportunity for local government to save a little bit of money by participating in a bulk purchase type agreement, paying their fair share of it, but nonetheless being able to enter into those type of relationships. And I don't know if that's occurring or if it can occur.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the simple answer is yes. It can occur. It does occur, and I think it could occur a lot more. I think over the last 5 years or so, the department has started much more effective working relationships at the ground level with various local governments, and in fact, the lack of dollars investment for maintenance of roadways for all of us at every level has actually forced all of us to look at partnerships and opportunities that we've never done before. So if you have particular issues or areas where you know of communities that are strapped, clearly when we're in town doing a big pavement preservation job, that is the opportunity to talk with us about extending contracts or unit quantities to other facilities in the road.
But it is a possibility.
You bet it's a possibility, and we welcome those kind of opportunities.
That's terrific.
Thank you so much for the time. I apologize for taking so much time.
No, I think we're the one that extended the time. Our apologies to you. And, Lori, I think what we're going to do, we're losing the committee here, and I have things to do, too. We'll just get back tomorrow with capital improvement. Well, can we do that? Are we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. We'll do that. And so I don't know if we actually opened under House Bill 5056. We went to public testimony and then moved backwards. But whatever, I'm going to close the hearing as appropriately opened. The gavel will be adjourned.